Nobody spends somebody else's money as carefully as he spends his own. Milton Friedman.
Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. The court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Right, she's recording. All right, y'all, welcome back. It's been far, far too long. Welcome back to another episode of Court is in Session. My guest is Francois Delecto, one of my favorites to have back on the show. And we are doing this under fantastic circumstances. I am on an Amtrak train from Washington, D.C. to Orlando, Florida, in a very Joe Biden kind of way, taking the Amtrak because, as I explained to Francois off air, I am a cheap bastard. So we've aptly decided to name this podcast as the American Banking Industry Off the Rails as we talk about Silicon Valley Bank. So Francois, thank you for joining me.
It's my pleasure, Court. Thanks for having me back on.
Anytime, and I apologize to my listeners, I'm talking a bit soft, more softly than I usually do, just because, again, I'm on a train. But Mr. Delecto, now I know neither of us have done too terribly much research into this, but I think it'll still make for a good conversation. Give us the just Cliff Notes version. What happened with Silicon Valley Bank? Why is it in the news so much?
Okay, now quick disclaimer. All the information I've merely gotten from my Twitter feed and push notifications from the Wall Street Journal that I don't read fully. But given that, the Cliff Notes version is that back during the very recent era of near zero interest rates, Silicon Valley Bank had a fairly attractive interest rate for venture capital firms that wanted to store their dry powder, their cash with them. It was just a little bit over 1%. I think it was around 1.5%. And that was very good for the time. So a lot of it pulled in a lot of capital. And I think their deposits were like they pulled in like $89 billion in 2021 or something like that, which is like almost as much as they had already had there. And the way they were able to maintain this fairly high interest rate for the environment was by investing by shelling it out into mostly fixed rate mortgage-backed security products, which were the highest yielding debt securities available at the time. However, now that is no longer the case because the Fed's been raising rates. These securities are much more difficult to trade, and therefore they haven't been able to really get them off their books and replace them with higher yielding bonds products. So they have not been able to give their depositors higher interest rates, so capital slowly began to, migrate to other banks that were giving a slightly better deal for people who had held cash in their accounts, and that began to threaten the liquidity of the bank. And the obviously, we as we all know, it got to the point that the FDIC had to step in, and it
So,
essentially became a bank run.
I was just about to ask, this people are calling this a bank run. Do you think this has the normal, in your opinion, is this kind of like the normal classic bank run that you see from like It's a Wonderful Life, where everybody
Well,
rushing to get their deposits out?
I did see some wonderful Twitter memes re referencing that scene, including one where it's like, imagine I'm doing this. I apologize in advance for my poor Jimmy Stewart impression. Was like, well, your money's not here. It's in a startup with queer POCs that are creating a neobank for college students and stuff like, and it's in Ukraine financing the war. So in the meme sense, yes, but obviously it was very different because this was not a place with a lot of normal retailers, and that's really why it's not a classic bank run. Because in a classic bank run, lots of small depositors would go and pull their money out of a bank, and it would really be like kind of a pandemonium type moment. However, Silicon Valley Bank was so susceptible to this because they had a small number of very large clients. And so it only took one or two of them to really get the snowball rolling. And it didn't require like a mass run as it would to take down something like, say, a Bank of America.
So I didn't realize that it was a large it was
Yes, they cater specifically to venture capital startups. That's why it's like, so they have the Silicon Valley name. They opened in, I believe, 1982, 83, sometime in the very early years of the Reagan administration. And they cater to startups, like maybe not the big startups like PayPal, but like the kind of things that will be seed funded by characters like Peter Thiel or Marc Andreessen, like kind of like, I guess, B-list tech companies, you know, ones that might not be household names, but were doing pretty well.
Okay. Now, it was interesting because at the beginning of the pandemic, I remember one of the first things that the Federal Reserve did that I thought really should have raised more eyebrows than it did was got rid of the reserve requirement. The reserve requirement where you know of, and they over leverage because I think that was part of the
Court, I'm really sorry, but I missed about 90% of what you said to Static. But I did hear that you suggested the Federal Reserve had changed the reserve requirements going into COVID and that a lot of these institutions became over-leveraged as a direct result of that. Is that the gist of what you just said?
That was the gist of what that comes to. That's about it. They allowed the reserve requirement and allowed, and I wonder if it allowed Silicon Valley Bank to be far leverage like it was.
That very well may be the case. As I stated previously, I only have a very loose understanding of this, so I couldn't speak to that. And you would know more about changes in Fed policy than myself. I do, however, am sure, however, that SVB does cater to a small number of very large clients rather than a large number of very small clients, and that was a major contributor to their catastrophe. And I'm sure what you just suggested likely did feed into it because it allowed them to really load up probably on these kind of low yielding MBS products.
Right.
But I couldn't tell you specifically. I will share that, however, that I did a statistic I read, which is that more than 97% of SVB depositors were not FIDEC insured. That's because less than 3% of depositors had $250,000 in their accounts or less. So as that means that almost all of their clients were pretty large businesses and only a very small number were kind of smaller mom and pop enterprises. Probably not mom and pop still, but you know what I mean.
That's interesting though, because the FDIC has said they're going to step in and
They have. In fact, they already have.
And they already have. Are they kind of bailing out these larger depositors, or are they only sticking to that 10% that had under $250,000, or are they only reimbursing?
Sorry, it was less than 3% that had under $250,000.
Oh, I thought you said 10%. Wow.
Excuse me. No, I said less than three, actually. From my understanding is they do intend to bail out all depositors, essentially, at least up to a certain point, and I think potentially up to the hilt. And this is a major break with policy that is, I'd say, unprecedented in American financial history, at least in the history of the FDIC.
Yeah, and it's not, man, that just seems like a bad idea.
It does seem like a bad idea, but what I find more concerning is that if they felt the need to take such a large step, it would mean either one, the people are handling this situation are a little bit crooked and they're trying to maybe help out their friends, or two, which is probably worse, the situation is more serious than we understand right now, and they felt they had to do this to prevent a broader crisis.
Well, I think there are...
Or maybe both, God forbid.
Maybe both, God forbid, but it seems like the international banking system is in more of a precipitous position than people think it is. I mean,
you're referring to Credit Suisse?
I'm referring to Credit Suisse for one.
Credit Suisse has been on the rocks for a little while, though, so that was a little less surprising.
It was a little less surprising, but that's still a thing to be concerned about. Deutsche Bank is incredibly over leveraged. That's an issue that's been on a lot of people's minds for a while.
That's true.
And then I also just read a statistic that Bank of America has something like $13 billion in unrealized losses on their books.
Yes, for similar issues. In fact, I read somewhere that by some accounting estimates, their unrealized losses may potentially be as high as 60% of their depositor value, or the equivalent of. I did admit I saw that number in a tweet, so I cannot verify it, but it is a concerning thing to see bouncing around.
So I think what's concerning about this too is generally the way these things work is one relatively small firm, maybe the Silicon Valley Bank of it all, kind of gets the ball rolling for a lot of these major collapses, like mm-hmm. Bear Stearns going out, leading to, you know, the financial crisis of 2008. And so I don't know. I'm kind of worried about the international banking system as a whole through this whole thing.
I will say that institutions such as Bank of America are less at risk than SVB was, because again, they have a much more diverse depositor base. Like, there's many small and medium size, essentially retail depositors, rather than a small number of extremely large or medium sized firms. So it would be more. It would take a greater psychological push to people to start withdrawing cash that would take down an institution of that size. However, what is concerning is that J.P. Morgan was having so many requests from clients that were trying to move funds from their other accounts at medium-sized banks to J.P. Morgan that they were not able to process them all at the same time. So I don't believe any of the major institutions such as Bank of America or J.P. Morgan are at risk, even though Bank of America is clearly having some issues. Right. More Silicon Valley bank-sized, namely First Republic and a few others, could be at risk as people try to flee to these larger banks, flee their capital.
So what do you think is, let's play a little worst case scenario, best case scenario. What is the best case scenario, do you think, to come out of this? Is it that the FDIC kind of resolves all these accounts and where everybody's just kind of getting in their head that there's more to worry about with these bigger banks than is case, and everything will be just golden? Or is there a better case than that?
I'd say the best case is that I'll pull up the journal right now. Yes, it's still the top headline that the several of the largest US banks, including led by JP Morgan and followed by Citigroup and about nine others, did deposit a collective $30 billion at First Republic, which is sort of the next most at-risk bank, and that kind of leaving that cash there should give them the stability, not just to weather through with deposit withdrawals, but probably to prevent them. And once, you know, it doesn't seem like this is an impending crisis, I think at least for the time being, it'll just kind of blow over, because this is a partly psychological phenomenon. If people aren't afraid that their money is going to disappear, they won't try to withdraw. And if they don't withdraw, then these banks won't blow up.
Now, why haven't they deposited that in Silicon Valley? Silicon Valley is still a going concern, if I understand it correctly.
Because the FDIC is like kind of on top of that. They are actually in, I don't know what the word is. They're in conservancy. That's not conservancy. It's a word like that, though. It's called receivership. They are in receivership. So they are now effectively and legally managed by the FDIC. So that's why they can't do that. So it's like it's a government institution now, like it's under their control, so putting that money there would no longer save it, because it's already gone into receivership. They've already lost kind of their, I guess, faith as an institution. Because going into receivership is, I suppose, the worst thing that can happen to you. You'd think it'd be bankruptcy, but I think receivership is probably worse, because it denotes more extraordinary circumstances than mere bankruptcy. Right. Whereas First Republic, although their stock has plunged by, I think, up to 65%, with this $30 billion injection, that they'll likely not go into receivership and just kind of muddle through this. And I guess this is the best case scenario, is that they just kind of like this kind of tides them over, and then nothing happens. except that they poor some poor earnings, I suppose. And I know Charles Schwab, which is the largest, is one of the largest brokerage firms in the country, is being affected by this, but they're not, but they're not because they're close to being insolvent, but because the way they make money is for people who like leave uninvested cash in their accounts. It is done into a cash sweep where they put in the Fed's overnight repo, and that's where they make a huge amount of their profit margin. Actually, is just by sweeping up all this stray cash that people leave around in their checking accounts and their brokerage accounts. And a lot of that money has been reduced as people move it into money market funds and into other institutions like a high yield JP Morgan savings account. So they're not going to, they're going to take a major earnings hit, and their stock has been hammered a little bit from that.
Mm. You foresee this being a major crisis? Is this another 2008, or should everybody put their money in gold and get a bunch of bullets and follow Ron Paul wherever
he is? I would say it is too soon to tell. I don't think it's as problematic as the 2008 situation, because those were you have to remember that's when the assets on the books of these investment banks such as Bear Stearns, such as Lehman, were going bad. Like, people were not paying their mortgages, and these assets were essentially going to zero or near zero, right?
Right.
Whereas the mortgages that backed up Silicon Valley Bank are still good. People are still paying them. They're just extremely unfavorable terms now for the creditors.
Right.
The people are still making their mortgages. They're still giving their yield, and at maturity, they'll be paid in full. As far as anyone can tell right now, there's no risk of them going bad. So
that's my thought on it.
Simply is not as radioactive as the 2008 crisis was.
I think I tend to agree with you there. I think people see issues going on with banks and they like to assume the worst. But the difference here is, just like you said, these assets are still good. And when
simply illiquid, that's their only issue.
Yeah, they're illiquid and they're perhaps a little overvalued. So there's going to be a correction in the market.
Sounds like they're properly valued, and that's been the trouble.
Well,
they're trading at like 40 cents on the dollar in some cases.
Well, there you go. Yeah, they're finding out now what the proper value of all of these assets are. Mm-hmm. But when your underlying assets are good, then you don't have these same just massive economic crises that she did before. At least that's my hope. But I always like to see it on the sunny side of things.
Yes, I would just add that that's why I was less upset that the FDIC backed all the depositors of Silicon Valley Bank, because the taxpayer is in return receiving is the custodianship of these good mortgage-backed securities that are still paying out.
So they'll be making money in the end.
I don't know what they're going to do with the spare change, but they're not buying right. Toxic assets. Like in 2008, the government stepped in and literally paid for trash, like genuinely bad assets. Whereas instead we're buying it for just not great assets, but they're fine.
Yeah.
You know, so it would be sort of like buying, instead of buying like rotten meat, we're buying Cheerios. Like, it's not good, but it's whatever. I didn't mean to diss Cheerios, excuse me, but you understand what I was trying to say.
Yeah, how dare you come on my podcast and diss Cheerios?
Yeah, I beg your pardon, and the pardon of Kellogg's or whoever owns them. But yeah, that's my several cents, my two cents.
Well, I can't say that I have too much to add. But
I will say I was curious to see what you thought of the reversal of QT that has been a result of this little situation. We've lost about 4 months of quantitative tightening progress in just a week. Based on the Fed balance sheet, based on the Fred data I saw today.
We have, and it's interesting too, because that came right on the heels of Jay Powell saying that he wants to, depending on how that jobs report went, he wanted to start tightening things up more, and everybody was really scared to see if the jobs report was too strong, then they were going to raise the interest rate quite a bit. And the jobs report was strong but not too strong. It seemed to strike that happy medium, and then we just hear about the Silicon Valley Bank failing. So Yeah, I don't. It'll be interesting to see how the Federal Reserve handles all of this, because you don't want to come on the heels of bank failure that's kind of making waves, and then continue to ratchet up the interest rate. But like you said, they've set back quantitative tightening a decent bit, so I feel like that's a hard line to walk. I think they need to start looking at the reserve ratio, like I said before. That's the not really start to ease up. So I think one, you're reflecting on the market that, or you're signaling to the market that you're going to focus on bank regulation and that there was a failure in the banks. So I think that makes you look tough as a Federal Reserve. And two, that's a means of monetary tightening that I think should be pursued anyway. So it'll be interesting to see what they do, but nobody's talking about the reserve ratio. And again, I don't know why, but if I was Jay Powell, that's what I would do instead of focusing on just that one tool that's, the interest rate.
Interesting. Yeah, I have to confess, I also was not thinking about the reserve ratio.
Yeah. So
How many
maybe.
basis points, if any, would you raise the interest rate if you were controlling this next FOMC?
If I was raising the interest rate.
Would you leave it the same, cut it a little bit, or would you give it a little more of a hike?
I certainly wouldn't cut it. I'd probably leave it be for a couple of months to let the dust kind of settle on this and then start ratcheting it up. I still think it needs to be higher than it is, but I think, like I said, you don't really do that right after, a bank failure. So I think, but after that, I'd go to a quarter of a percentage point or a quarter basis point and see how the market kind of reacts to that. Before going too much further, but that would be in a couple of months that I would do that.
Well, I am not well versed in the Austrian school, but I do believe that they believe that crises such as this have the potential to sweep out malinvestment from the economy so that capital in the long term may be deployed more efficiently. Do you think that there could be a silver lining to some bank failures if we simply let them fail so that some executives can face consequences for their for some of their more risky decisions?
Yeah, I've long thought that. I mean, markets are there to signal how good or bad assets are, right? So I think if you create a government system that basically sh signals to investors, like, if you're a big investor and you make bad decisions, we'll come and bail you out, like it seems the FDIC is doing. Even if they're decent assets, they're still bailing out major investors. Then I think you incentivize an economy of reckless large investors. I'm not an Austrian, but I am inspired a lot by the Austrian tradition, and that's one of my things. Like, if you're having banks go under because of bad investment
Attention, ladies
practices,
and
then
gentlemen, may
the
I have your
investors
attention,
need
please?
to
This
they need to
announcement will
face the
serve
music
as
of
our
their bad
last announcement for
investments.
the evening. Once again, this is our last announcement for the evening. Between the hours of 10 p.m. and 7 a.m., there are no announcements made. If your stop falls between those times, you will be approached directly by a member of the crew and instructed where to detrain. For this reason, we do ask that you please remain in your assigned seats so we may find you throughout the night and detrain you at your designated stops. Also, in just a few minutes, the lights will be turned off in all coach cars. Once again, the lights will be turned off in all coach cars. They'll be turned back on after 7 a.m. tomorrow morning. When the lights are off in the coaches, it is quiet time, which means if you are using any electronic devices, you must use headphones with these devices. We ask that you be mindful and considerate of the passengers sitting around you. Headphones must be used with all personal devices. If you're having a conversation on your cell phone or with a fellow passenger, you may take those conversations to the sitting area in the cafe car. It is open throughout the night. Once again, be mindful and considerate of the passengers sitting around you.
Well, I've just been informed by the
Throughout the
act.
night, we do have other passengers joining us at our different station stops. We ask that if the seat next to you is unoccupied, that you maintain it clear of all personal belongings and make all seats available for those passengers joining us. Once again, if the seat next to you is unoccupied, maintain it clear of all personal belongings. All seats will be used. Those passengers would like to purchase any snacks, beverages, or anything, because we do have a cafe.
at this time. Our cafe car will close at 10:30 this evening. If you'd like to purchase any items tonight, we ask that you do so by that time. The cafe car will close at 10:30, reopen at 6:15 tomorrow morning. The cafe car is located at the center of the train, to the rear of all coach cars and forward of all sleepers. Our next station stop in approximately 10 minutes will be Richmond Staples Mill Station. Once again, Richmond will be next approximately 10 minutes from now. Once again, Richmond will be the next stop. It is approximately 10 minutes to the Richmond Station. Please take this time to make sure you have all personal belongings in hand. Please check around your seat and any overhead luggage rack. When you train and exit, only where is indicated by a uniformed crew member. Not all doors will be opening for the Richmond stop. Once again, Richmond is next approximately 10 minutes from now. If you have any questions, any comments, or concerns, feel free to ask any uniform member of the staff. We will be more than happy to assist you in any way we can. We do want to thank you for choosing Amtrak as your mode of transportation. Hope you have a pleasant evening. Once again, Richmond Staples Mill Station is our next stop in approximately 10 minutes.
Well, I have been told by the voice of God that it is almost quiet time. So,
are you in the dining car?
I am not in the dining car. And the dining car is several cars over from me, but it's also coming up on half an hour anyway. So, Mr. Delecto, do you have any final thoughts on this, or any final mini lectures about the Silicon Valley banking crisis that you want to impart to our listeners? While
no, I think I said really all that I have to say right now. Is there anything you can add really quick, Court?
Nothing that I can really add. The lights are off, so I think with that, we're just going to end our podcast. And yeah, thank you for joining me on this lovely train ride and helping pass the time. And I hope that our listeners learned a little something from our ill-educated take on the incident.
Me too. Thanks again, Court.
Thank you.